The following presentation is from North Pine Baptist Church. We trust that it will help you learn more about God and His message for the world. For more information and to connect with us, visit npbc.org.au.
Shush, had a good time. Because that makes a good talk. My name's Michael, my dad is Bill, so that's, I guess, the most famous person that you would, each of us would know on some level. I'm a dad. I have four kids, all boys. We live at Murrumba Downs, about 300-400 metres that way, I feel like. Probably a bit further than that. Not Castle Hill. I'm a teacher. Say no more, hey. I've got a Bachelor of Arts and a Bachelor of Education, and I'm a teacher. I teach history and legal studies at Mueller College, which you possibly have heard of. Dave French, who I saw before, is a teacher there as well. Dave's a great teacher. I also have an interest in politics. Back in, I finished my university degree about 2002, I think it was. I think I was married in 2003. And then just kind of got on just being a person with a job, working, all those sorts of things. And about in my fifth year of teaching, I started getting involved with World Vision and their 40-hour famine, which you may have heard of. And through that, got to meet Tim Costello, who was quite an inspiring figure for me at that time. Through him, I got very interested in poverty and how on earth we might be able to do something about that. I picked up a book on Tim's recommendation. I went to him after a talk just for teachers who are running the 40-hour famine that they put on just to try and inspire the teachers, sort of thing. And I said, is there anything you'd recommend I read? And he said, you should read The End of Poverty by Jeffrey Sachs. So I went and got that like 2 days later and read it really, really quickly. And it convinced me that, yes, some poverty is unavoidable. Some poverty is just part of the fact that life goes up and down and natural disasters will come and all those sorts of things. But that some other forms of poverty are quite avoidable. Some forms of poverty exist because people make bad choices, governments do bad things. And because some of it is avoidable, something should be done about that particular type of poverty. So I read that book and was convinced that something could be done. And perhaps one way that things could be done is through parliament, through politics. So shortly after, I started a Master of Arts in International Politics. So I've got an MA as well. And then I set about the, I don't know, foolhardy goal of getting more involved in politics. That was an interesting experience. The thing you got to know about politics in Australia is it's a very shallow pool. There's not very many people that are interested. And there's a lot of reasons why. Part of it is because it's horrible. If you get involved in politics, just prepare to be attacked every day from then on. And just see how you go with that. Like, that's what politics is. And then we wonder, why is it that a certain type of person gets involved? A certain hard nut who doesn't care about anyone? We're like, well, that's because we treat them like they need to not care. Because we're not very nice to our politicians. Which I don't necessarily think is a bad thing, actually. I like that Australians distrust power. I think we shouldn't trust power too much. But at the same token, it takes a certain type of person to get involved in politics and to succeed. I did okay. I got into a political party. I chose a political party on the basis of meeting Peter Dutton. I met Peter Dutton. I asked him, what is he going to do about global poverty? He said, you just need to get more organised. I said, the Make Poverty History campaign is the biggest poverty campaign in the history of the world. How much more organised do we need to be? And he said, more than that. I'm like, okay, I'm going to run against you. And I did. I ran against him a couple of years later. I got 35,000 votes, which was not enough. In the election that came next, I was the candidate again, but about 6 months out from the election, my wife and I had our fourth child, who's got significant disability. I pulled out of the election because I had to put family first. That's a logical and sensible thing to do, and kind of just stopped really getting directly involved in politics from that point forward, and more just, I don't know, do talks like this, a bit about how I think people who aren't like that keen to get into like actually represent your area politics, which is general politics. So that's what we're going to talk about today. I've written a ridiculously long talk, but all of it's good, and I'll just stop at about 45-ish, 30-ish minutes, and we'll just cut the rest, and that'll be fine. Like, there's no real end, I guess, is what I'm saying. It's just lots of different bits, and we'll just see how much we can get through, and if it's of value, I hope that's really good. Let's first talk about the perception of politics and Christians today. If I could use my clicker, because I've got one of these. Oh, look, third Monday night talks. When I saw that the acronym was TMNT, that made me just think of Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, which I grew up with. Fantastic. I think you should use that as your logo, just a tip. Christianity and politics, landscape and perception. So if I was to go into a political party and start talking about my faith, or if I was to go to a rally and talk about my faith, or at the workplace and talk about my faith and its relationship to politics, there's a lot of things that might come up right now. I've got a video, if we could quickly go to this. This is a video of Donald Trump when he was trying to court the religious vote during the recent presidential election. You'd be curious to hear how he thought was the best way to make sure that Christians would vote for him.
I really appreciate the support given to me by the evangelicals. They've been incredible. Every poll says how well I'm doing with them. And, you know, my mother gave me this Bible, this very Bible, many years ago. In fact, it's her writing right here. She wrote the name and my address, and it's just very special to me. And again, I want to thank the evangelicals. I will never let you down.
I mean, I don't mean to be super cynical, but I don't think owning a Bible makes you a Christian necessarily, and it was given to him. But that's one perception. So if I say, what do Christians in politics look like? It looks like Donald Trump courting the religious vote by saying his mum gave him a Bible once. Right now, we have our first, in a long time, Christian Prime Minister. That's Scott Morrison. I'm pretty convinced he's a legit Christian. He's also a Pentecostal Christian, though, which has a bit of baggage that comes alongside of it. Interesting, a lot of the conversations in the media talk about how this is going to bring the religion and state thing back into public discourse, and I think they're probably right. I think you'll probably hear more about this than less over the next little while. There we go. In Spain, Spain's quite a Catholic religious country, but it just had its first atheist prime minister elected. And he didn't swear on the Bible or a crucifix or anything, which is a tradition in Spain. And he's set forth a secularization agenda, and he even calls it that, a secularization agenda. The idea being that his goal is to make sure religious activities get no funding from government anymore. So that's the kind of spectrum that we're looking at in democracies in the world today. We have some who are trying to manipulate the Christian vote. We have people who are Christians in politics, and we have people who are anti-Christian in politics. We have everyone, basically. There's a thing in Australia called the Australian Christian Lobby, which you probably have heard of. This is just off their website. So they would see as the four big issues facing Christianity in politics at the moment: as surrogacy law, prayer in parliament, abortion, I should say abortion, I think it auto-corrected on me there, and gender law. And this is what other popular perceptions might be. It's everything is kind of what it is, isn't it? Like I have friends who are socialists who would say they're Christians. I have friends who are strong Republic or conservatives who would be Christians. The Salvation Army is big in Australia, obviously Christian. That's Westboro Baptists there who picket funerals of people who weren't Christians, and just to remind them how much, I don't know, terrible things that they think. So let's, instead of talking about what it is today, what I'm going to try and do in about 10 minutes is do an entire history of politics and the Bible from the beginning to the end of the Bible. It's going to be fast, and I'll probably make a few mistakes. I don't have a degree in theology. The only degree in theology I got is from my dad, so it's his fault if I get this part wrong. I've given this a red hot crack. I'll go super fast, and don't feel like you need to keep up, okay? Just get a bit of a sense of what God and government looks like in the Bible. All right, here we go. So it begins in the beginning. In Genesis, the Lord God took man and put him in the Garden of Eden to work it, care of it. And the Lord God commanded the man. In fact, who did the commanding? Who made the laws? God made the laws. What was the law? You're free, but. You're free to do it, but this one. Like, he made the laws, right? And he also told us to fill the earth and subdue it. I'll skip to the bits underlined, though I'll give the whole verses in these slides just for context's sake, but I don't want to be slowed down too much. So in the beginning, God was like ruler, and we were the ruled. And under as being ruled, we had certain responsibilities that we had to fulfill. And then sin happened. You remember the story? Yep. And then a couple of things happened straight away. The punishment of sin was that the husband would rule over the wife. So before, God in charge with the ruled, now suddenly we have rulership entering into the human domain where one human rules over another, and it would be hard. I think that's a pretty good metaphor for what government is like. It's hard. Yes? Well, I think we'd all agree. Cursed is the ground. Painful toil. Yes, that sounds like trying to run the world. Then a bit later, we have the period of the nation where God said to Abraham, I'm going to make you into a great nation. And through this nation, we're going to do good things. We're going to make blessings occur. So we took this idea that we can do good through a government system, through a thing called a nationhood, through nationness. Not that that's really a word. And then what you might know of the story is that the Israelites eventually going to Egypt because they're starving. And Joseph, you might know the story of Joseph, he got taken to Egypt and kind of became a bit of a slave and then kind of worked his way up sort of thing through a long time. Lots of horrible things happened to Joseph. But by God's cleverness, God's planning, it just so happened that at the time the Israelites were really struggling, was dying for food, they went to Egypt, you might know the story, and they asked for food. And who was in charge? Who was the guy who was giving the food away? It was Joseph, right? And this is a famous words of Joseph here where he says to his bros, you intended to harm me, but God intended it for good. That is, you tried to kick me out of here and be horrible to me, but by you doing that, I became in this powerful position and was able to do good with it. This government system at the time was a pagan monarchy where we had a pharaoh who would call himself a god king, a divine king. And in that system, despite that being the new government system in Egypt at the time, God was able to do good things with it. Then after they kind of bailing from Egypt, when that happens, we have a period of judges. This is kind of the precursor to judges, but you can see the principle here that then the judges period of Israelite history kind of applies. So you had that old guy named Moses who was trying to like run everything and it was just not working because he's only one dude and who can run everything as one person. And so God said, appoint people as officials over thousands, hundreds, fifties and tens. So as a way to solve a problem, God said, well, maybe we should create like a system, like an administrative system, a type of government to manage the affairs of this bunch of people trying to live life in a desert. And that principle of giving people certain administrative roles continued on through the judges period of biblical history. Then, you might know about this too, after that, eventually, the Israelite people are like, we don't like this judges thing where everyone just has their little role. We want someone on top of all of them called a king. All our neighbors have kings. Kings are awesome. Can we please have a king? I love this part. This is God speaking here. He says, listen to Samuel. Because Samuel, can you ask God if we can have a king? And Samuel goes, oh, I'll just go talk to him. Samuel goes and talks to God, and God says, listen to all that the people are saying to you. It is not you they have rejected, but they have rejected me, that is God, as their king. So Samuel says, they want a king, and God's like, oh, can't I be king? Like, I'm a good king. You should keep me as king. That would be better. But let them know what the king who will reign over them will do. Listen to them and give them a king. God basically says, it'd be better if I was your king. But you can have a king if you really want a king. It's an interesting principle there, I think. I'll try and pull it all together in a moment. Eventually the kings are in charge and things start to go a bit wrong. I'm rushing through biblical history here. I'm sorry, that's a million miles an hour. And then God starts condemning the rulers. He starts saying, you're not doing a good job, which God knew was going to happen, but anyway. And this is what he says, woe to those who make unjust laws, to those who issue oppressive decrees to deprive the poor of their rights and withhold justice from the oppressed. So God says, you can have a king, and then the kings are in charge and they start making a bit of garbage out of it. And God says, these are the things you're supposed to be doing. Like, if you're going to make laws, these are the sort of laws that you need to be making to do a good job. Then they get kicked out as a consequence of their corruption. They go into exile. And what are they told to do in exile? So that means, if you don't know your biblical history, a foreign power came in, took the Israelites, got most of them, all the good ones, and brought them out of their city into a foreign city where they became a minority with very few rights. And what were you supposed to do in that situation? Well, the commandment is, in underline, seek the peace and prosperity of the city. If it prospers, you too will prosper. In other words, yes, you're not in charge anymore. It's not an Israelite as king, it's some other dude as king. But while you're in this exile, this period where you don't have power, just do your best to make the city better. Do your best to make the city peaceful. Because if it's good and peaceful, it's good for you as it is for everybody else. Then eventually they get out of exile and they go back home. And Nehemiah, good book of the Bible, I really like it. He gets them all to get going. And one of the ways he motivated them, because you've got to remember when they went back to Jerusalem to rebuild the destroyed city, it wouldn't have just been Jews there now. There would have been a bunch of other people that have moved in. It would have been a bit of a mixture. And Nehemiah, as part of a way to convince people that this is a good thing to do, just said, let's just do it for the common good. Jerusalem will be better if we build walls for everyone who lives in Jerusalem. So let's build walls. Let's commit ourselves to the common good. And then the Romans come along a bit later after that. And they're in charge of everything. And then this is Paul, the apostle here speaking, saying, well, we're not in charge again. This is what we're going to do. We're going to submit ourselves, or submit himself, to the governing authorities, next underlined part, not only because of possible punishment, but also because of conscience. And that's it. That's the whole Bible and every kind of government system that kind of interacts with it at some point. I think I got it done in about 10. I tried my best. I apologize for the errors. I made a lot of things more simple than they really are. But I wanted to kind of move on through. Here's the points. This is the bit where hopefully you can stay with me, because that part might have been way too much too fast. Five biblical principles. One, God desires more than anything else that he be the Lord of our lives. So we can talk about government as much as we like. What's the thing that God cares most about? Who's Lord? And on a personal level, that probably should be the thing you care about most. That said, God sees human governance as a perhaps even necessary consequence of sin. Human governance didn't really come in until sin came in, and now it's in. God's happy to let it be used as a means of making sense of this world. There are lots of consequences of sin that in some ways are necessary, like death. Like if there was no death, we'd have to live in this horrible place forever, right? Like there's a certain blessing with death. It puts an end. Like if Julius Caesar was still alive today, I think the world would be in a very bad state. Like there'd be genocides happening all over the place. But fortunately, he's dead. There's a strange blessing in that punishment, isn't there? And I think that this ruling over, which was a punishment, is also in some ways a kind of blessing, because at least it makes sense of this horrible world. It's better than it could be. Not that it's awesome. God also allows us to dictate our preferred form of government. So there is no biblical, this is the way the government has to be structured according to the Bible, because the Christian people, godly people, managed to find a way to live their existence under every form of government that existed in biblical times. So we can kind of make a choice for ourselves there. It's kind of like God doesn't care what colored shirt you wear today, just use what works for you. God expects, that said, so the form of government God doesn't care super much about, but he does care. Like, woe to you if this doesn't happen. He expects government to provide justice and welfare. So he'll condemn a government. He'll speak loudly about a government doing bad things if they don't provide justice and welfare. And last one, and God wants his people to seek the common good regardless of the government system. So if you're in charge, do what's good for people. If you're not in charge, do what's good for people. As a general principle. So there's five biblical principles in terms of what the Bible says about Christians, or it wasn't really Christians before Jesus, but we'll just pretend it is because they're still saved by Jesus. So Christians and politics, this is kind of some principles that we can take into account. Let's do some more history. I'm a history teacher, so I'm going to do more history now. Is that okay? I hope it's okay. I know I'm going really fast. Let's go from the end of the Bible to now, okay? So the next big history lesson. I'm going to use a diagram for this part too. I quite like diagrams. They're a good way to make complicated things deceptively simple. It may not work for you. If it doesn't make sense, don't get too stressed. It's just my attempt to try and pull a lot of big Christian thinkers together in one place. All right, so God since government. Okay, so since people first became Christians, this was the world that they lived in. We must obey God rather than man. What that means is that there was this problem that the early Christians faced in the sense that the governing authorities were not Christian. And so there was a direct conflict sometimes between what a Christian wants to do and what a non-Christian ruler might want to do. A classic one is Caesar Lord. And that was a big issue for the early Christians because they didn't think Caesar was Lord, and many went to and died because they refused to acknowledge Caesar as Lord. That was the unique situation that Acts was in. And they often found themselves, well, we should submit to the authorities on the one hand, but what if submitting to the authorities makes me want to do something that is completely ungodly? Well, then we must obey God rather than man. That was the moral dilemma that these early Christians had to face. That didn't last that long in modern history because then we had, in 380, Christianity becoming the official religion of Rome. So we had the New Testament was written in a period where being Christianity, particularly the letters and Acts and stuff after Jesus, was written in a period of history where Christianity wasn't like really welcomed. It's kind of seen as this random weird thing happening in Judah, like, well, what's going on over there? Who knows? To eventually being seen as a threat, and then eventually becomes the official religion of Rome, which presented a problem because Christianity grew up in this world where we're not in charge. For generations, they'd grown up in the belief system where they're not in charge. So what are you supposed to do now that you are in charge? How do Christians lead when they're in charge? That's a tough one. And the first guy who had a good crack at it, I reckon, was Augustine. And this is what he said. He wrote a book called The City of God. And here's a quote from him. Well, actually, it's not a quote from him. It's a quote from someone else describing what he said. Sorry. Augustine distinguished, this is where the diagram comes in, between the eternal city of God and the temporal city of man. Here we go. So we have two cities, the city of God and the city of man. Two rival cities shaped by opposing loves and working towards different ends. So when you become a Christian, as a believer, you operate in the city of God with certain rules and obligations that you attempt to live by, right? Prior to that, there are other things that you live by and hope to achieve. So a good example of that would be sanctification. Okay, so a person who's just in the city of man is probably not going to live their life trying to be sanctified. It's not like their top goal for the, you know, the random person who works at 7-Eleven. That they just live in their city of man trying to do man things like earn a decent wage, buy a house, go on a holiday. When you enter into the city of God as a believer, then a whole new other bunch of things become part of your life that you start caring about too. So that's how he kind of tried to make sense of what is going to happen now that we have this situation where the city of God is in charge. Well, let's just quickly, he's like by going, let's just divide the two groups and recognize that they're not the same. They're not going to want the same things. Then another guy showed up named Thomas Aquinas. This is a long time later, like almost 1,000 years between Augustine and Aquinas, but there was a dark ages period between that, so not much was written down in that bit. Anyway, Thomas Aquinas said this: participation in the eternal law by the rational creature, that is called the natural law. Now, there's a biblical way of saying that. This is from Romans. It says, men are without excuse. The requirements of the law are written on their hearts. Now try and stay with me for a moment here. What I think Aquinas is trying to say is, yes, as Christians, we try and do certain things with our life, and people who aren't try and do certain things with their life, but there is a bit of overlap. There's some things that both Christian people and non-Christian people do try and do with their life. Like we try and care for our children, most as a general rule. C.S. Lewis has a good line about it. I've got the quote here. He always has a good line about everything, that guy. If a man will go into a library and spend a few days with the Encyclopedia of Religion and Ethics, he will soon discover the massive unanimity of the practical reason in man. From the Babylonian hymn to Samos, from the laws of Manu, the Book of the Dead, the Analects, the Stoics, the Platonists, the Australian Aborigines and Redskins, he will collect the same triumphantly monotonous denunciations of oppression, murder, treachery and falsehood. The same injunctions of kindness to the aged, the young and the weak, of almsgiving and impartiality and honesty, that should say. he will no longer doubt that there is such a thing as the law of nature. What he's saying is if you were to study all the legal codes of every civilization that's ever existed, you would be struck by how similar they are. Not in every way, but in most ways. Which means that we can kind of draw a Venn diagram with this. Though we do live in two opposing cities, there is a thing in the middle which Aquinas would call natural law. Things which we all kind of agree are right and wrong. Yeah, you with me so far? Is that kind of making sense? All right, so that's what Aquinas said. Then other thinkers add to this. And they didn't have a Venn diagram to write their philosophy, right? They drew, like, wrote really long books. This is just my attempt to try and make it a bit more understandable. So Luther came along. He's a very famous thinker. You've probably heard of him. He operated in a system where, so this is a giant, like, bracket thing here, where state and church ruled over everyone, right? So whether you're in the city of God, whether you're in the city of man, God and state and the church, they were in charge. And Luther famously disagreed with the church, the Catholic Church at the time, recognizing there's some issues here with the way the church is doing things. So had this to say, which is important to our discussion tonight. He worked out something that's quite different between natural law and city of God law. This is what he said in just one of his literary works. He said, worldly authority cannot force us to believe. So though state and church is overall in this government system of the kind of Reformation period, state can't rule over the city of God in the same way. Like the prime minister can't say, you will be a Christian. Like it doesn't. That's not how it works. He goes on to explain what he means. He's talking about the particulars of heresy here and what to do about them. So how could we oppose the heretics? And you say, that is the task of the bishop. So if there's some false teaching in a church, whose job it is to deal with the false teaching? Luther would say, that's the task of bishops. It is not within the sphere of princes. Okay, so government officials shouldn't involve themselves with spiritual matters that relate to a church. Heresy cannot, after all, be opposed with violence. Like you can't imprison someone because they're not a Christian. Well, you can, but this kind of doesn't make them a Christian by imprisoning them, right? Like, none of you became a Christian if you are one. I'm kind of presuming you are, to be honest. But if you are a Christian, I'm presuming it wasn't because you were afraid of going to prison that you became one. Like, there's something different about the way that works. It must be handled differently, for this balanced striving may not be met with the sword. So the Christian life, the city of God life, is not the same as the natural law life of murder. We have laws about murder. We don't have laws about you have to be a Christian. So it's almost like Luther kind of just drew like a really faint dotted line here. It's like, yes, state and church is over everything, but the way we deal with city of God matters is slightly different to the way we deal with other legal matters, other political matters. They're not the same thing. Then we had the Protestant Reformation, which kind of threw things into massive problems because you had a church divided. So if state and church are in charge, well, which church was the question that was so often asked in many countries? Is it the Catholic Church, who still had many of the old kind of political positions? When the church is divided, which church do we follow? It's a tough question, fair enough question. Locke came along and he kind of provided the answer. So he's another very famous and clever philosopher. He lived between 1632 and 1704. I couldn't remember that, so I wrote that one down for you. And this is what he said. He went out of England and went and visited France, and he went and visited Holland, and he saw this remarkable thing happen there where Catholics and Protestants weren't killing each other. And he was like, why the heck are they not killing each other? They were back in England. And this is the conclusion that he came to. In his book, something about tolerance. Do you remember the name of it, Dad? There we go. Oh, thank you. On toleration. There we go. And this is what he said. I esteem it. He said many things. This is just one thing to do with government. I esteem it above all things necessary to distinguish exactly, that's the key word here, I think, the business of civil government and that of religion. That is, John Locke saw the dotted line that Luther had drawn that said the church is to do with this, the state is to do with that. And Locke said, actually, let's just make that a thick line. And the church is to do with this, and the state is to deal with that. And this worked remarkably well for peaceful purposes, because once church and state were separated, if you wanted to be a Protestant, you no longer had to go and kill the government. You could just freely be a Protestant. It actually kind of worked reasonably well for the people at the time. But many of us look back on it now and we think, it's a shame that church and state got separated. This happened. That's done. Church and state are no longer one. They got joined together in about 380 BC and they got separated. It's hard to put a date on it, maybe 1791, when the First Amendment in America was written, which basically said you can have whatever religion you want, the government's not going to legislate on it. And that is kind of where we are today. All right, so four principles that we can get out of this history lesson. I know this is a lot of info, hopefully you're staying with me. One, Christianity does not have to be directly involved in government to exist. It has functioned perfectly well when it wasn't in government, and it's continued to exist when it was. So I know we get stressed out sometimes at the end of Christendom, and I get that. I'm frustrated too. But guess what? Jesus is bigger. It'll be okay. Two, Christianity will inevitably have opportunities to speak into government systems at some points in history. You have a bit of an opportunity now because we're in a democracy, probably worthwhile making some use of that power. The Christian theory of government over the past 2,000 years has tended towards a natural law or common good agenda, a bit like the exile period. Remember how when they were in exile, it was like, seek the good of the city. You're not in charge, but seek peace and prosperity anyway. I kind of feel like that's what Australia is a bit like at the moment. We're not in charge. The Christian voice is not the in-charge voice in Australia. It's a little bit of the minority voice. It's still a sizable minority, I'd add. It's not like fringe. But it's not the boss anymore. And the separation of church and state is unlikely to change anytime soon. It took 1,700 years to get to that kind of thing. It probably will take another 1,700 to undo it if you want it to go back again. Four modern principles. All right. How are we going? We're going okay. I've gone for half an hour now. Do you want to do another topic? All right. Christians in politics today. Okay. Here's Philip Yancey. This is just a good quote, just to get our bearings. Oh, yes. Yeah. Go back one. Yeah, no worries at all. So Philip Yancey is a Christian thinker. He writes really beautifully, actually. It's good for me because he writes in a way that I don't think. Like, I think through logic and history, and he doesn't think that way at all. And so it's good for me to read people who don't think like me. But this is what he talks about as his teenage experience of Christianity. Sometimes in a waiting room or on a plane, I strike up a conversation with strangers, during the course of which they learn that I write books on spiritual themes. Eyebrows are raised, barriers spring up, and often I hear yet another horror story about church. Maybe that's your experience when you let someone know that you go to church, and they're like, what the? Yeah. My seatmates must expect me to defend the church, because they always act surprised when I respond, oh, it's even worse than that, let me tell you a story. I've spent most of my life in recovery from the church. This is Philip Yancey talking. I think this book was about how he kind of got over his hatred of the church. It's a good read, actually. He talks about his story, and this, oh man, I read this and I'm like, yes, I get what you're talking about. After high school, I attended a Bible college in a neighboring state. More progressive than my home church, the school had admitted one black student. To stay on the safe side, they assigned him a roommate from Puerto Rico. This college believed in rules, many rules, 66 pages worth, in fact, which we students had to study and agree to abide by. As a final year student, so this is a guy who's probably in his early 20s, engaged, like to be married, I could, as a rule of the college, spend only at the dinner hour from 5:40 until 7 p.m. with the woman who is now my wife. Classic, isn't it? Once we got caught holding hands and were put on restriction, forbidden to see each other or speak for 2 weeks. Outside, somewhere in the great world beyond, other students were demonstrating against the war in Vietnam, marching for civil rights on a bridge near Selma, Alabama, and gathering to celebrate love and peace in Woodstock, New York, whilst we were preoccupied with Sarianism and measuring skirts and hair. Which is just a way of saying, I think anyway, that there is a tendency that we've got to be aware of for Christians to just start caring about Christian stuff and being really in shop and not be aware there's a whole other world out there that perhaps we could get involved in a little bit. So let's have a talk about that. What does the politics mean? It comes from the word polis, which means city, and polites, which means citizens, or politica, which means affairs of the citizens. That's where the word comes from. I think there's two definitions that people use. The broad one is it's about how we live together, and there's a narrow one, which is about the science of government. I think if we define it broadly, then you should probably get involved in politics because it's about how we live together. I think the narrow one with the science of government, I don't think there's a rule. Let's talk about the broad definition. This is from Ephesians. You'd know the words. I'll just read the underlined parts. By grace you have been saved. This is how you become a Christian, by grace. Why? To do good works. So there's that second part to Christianity that says it's not just about salvation. There's another bit to it. N.T. Wright talks about it. I'm going to skip that because I'm going too long. We'll just go to his part here. N.T. Wright says, his death and resurrection transformed the world. That transformation can happen to you. And then you in turn can be part of the transforming work. Right? So Christianity is about you being transformed by the gospel and then transforming the world by the same power that transformed you. So there is a sense that if the Christian life is about making everything a little bit better as well as being saved, then I think we would understand that, yes, that means we have to be a little bit political at times. Jesus was political in that broad sense. Very political. Not narrowly political. He didn't run for office. But he did heal people. Remember, healed people were cast out in this society and he brought them in. That was a very political thing to do. There was a woman caught in adultery, and who did he stand up for? The woman caught in adultery before she repented. Crazy. He said this, whatever you do for one of the least of these, you did not do for, what you did not do for one of the least of these, you did not do for me. He identified himself with those who society said didn't matter. Like that disabled kid, you didn't care. It's like you didn't care for me. That was a radical thing to say in that society. He has anointed me to preach, this is in the Gospel of Luke, he has anointed me to preach the good news to the poor. He sent me to proclaim freedom for the prisoners and recovery of sight for the blind, to release the oppressed, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor. There's something about the metaphors that God uses to describe what he's doing that seem to always point towards those who are suffering and struggling. Turn the other cheek, give your cloak and tunic, walk 2 miles. These were all political acts. To turn the other cheek was to flip this power thing on its head. See, in Roman society, you were allowed to beat someone a little bit, but if you beat them a lot, that was a bad thing. And here you are challenging them to beat you a lot. With the give your cloak, this would make you basically naked. They lived in a shame culture. To give your cloak would basically make you naked, which would be embarrassing for them to see. It shames the shamer. When you walk 2 miles, it actually is a way of making a soldier being trouble of being caught, because soldiers weren't supposed to let someone else carry their gear. They were proud of the fact that they could carry their gear. If you gave it to a poor guy and said, carry my gear, and the centurion saw you having someone else carry your gear, you'd probably be punished for it. I can just see it. This legionnaire chasing a poor man saying, give me back my stuff. Give me back. They're going to see. Blessed are the poor in spirit, meek, merciful, pure, peacemakers, persecuted. Jesus was highly political in a broad sense. Not in a narrow sense, but in a broad sense, very much so. This is how Mary and Paul describe Christ. Mary said, he has brought down rulers from their thrones, but has lifted up the humble. This is Paul doing it. God chose the foolish things of the world to shame the wise, chose the weak things of the world to shame the strong. So 3 rules for Christians in politics. If you're good or interested in the science of government, be informed and go for it. If that's your particular calling and you're good at that, there's no rule saying don't do it. Do what you're good at. If you're not, the requirement of Christians is to be a good citizen, to love God and to love others, to champion the common good. Getting this right isn't easy. But that's not an excuse to quit. I get it's hard. It's hard to love God and love others in this world that we're in today. Okay, so what should I actually do? Last thing, and then we're done. First, I think you should do evangelism, because no one else is going to do that. While it'd be tempting for us to start an aid organization to go and help the poorest of the poor, just realize that the aid organizations aren't doing evangelism. Only Christians do evangelism, and that's really important. Acts 19 has this great story where a bunch of idol sellers have a riot. Like, really angry. No one's buying our idols anymore. I'm so annoyed. We're going to riot because these Christians are disrupting the cult of Artemis. And they go to the court and they say, charge these guys. They're stopping our idol selling. And the Christians get let off. And why do they get let off? Because they didn't do anything to try and disrupt the market of the idol sellers. The only thing they did was people became Christians. And guess what? They stopped buying idols of their own accord. The best way to change a society is just by people becoming Christians, and then society will kind of change on its own. So don't lose sight of the main thing. Do evangelism. That is the best way the church can actually change the world, by people becoming Christians and having the Holy Spirit change their lives. You should do justice as well. The thing is with justice is it probably means different things to different people in the room. There are three definitions of justice, and you've got to care about all of them. And they contradict a little bit, so you've got to hold them in tension. First one is you've got to protect freedom. This is like Proverbs justice. All hard work brings a profit, but mere talk leads only to poverty. What that means is one form of justice is getting what you deserve. If you don't work, you don't eat. That's justice. Makes sense, yes? We should go for that. We should be in favor of that. Teaching our kids, work hard, then you eat. Don't work hard, you're not going to eat. But that's too simplistic to keep on its own. Some of us just stick there. That's not enough. Justice means maximizing welfare and opportunity as well. This is from Philippians. Do nothing out of selfish ambition or vain conceit. Rather, in humility, value others above yourselves, not looking to your own interests, but each of you to the interests of the others. So actually, we need to have this kind of, yes, you get what you deserve, justice, but we also have to have this, well, sometimes the system is so mean and wrong that it disadvantages people who didn't deserve it, and we need to correct that stuff. But then there's also another type of justice, which is just living right. Here's two verses on it. There's a little weird L-sep there. I don't know what that means. Anyway, this is the first dot point. Now, all of you have heard, here's the conclusion of the matter. Fear God, keep his commandments, for this is the duty of all mankind. Just stick to being a good Christian person, right? And it's kind of supported in Matthew. Let your light shine before others, that they may see your good deeds and glorify your Father in heaven. You know, there's a salt and light passage. We need to be salt and light. The salt one is about preserving. The light one is about shining so that people see it and glorify God as a result. Maybe a good way to judge whether the things you're doing are the right political thing is it shining a light, and is it causing people to glorify God as a result? If it's causing people to not glorify God, you just need to have a think about it. It might still be okay because there's other types of justice at play here. But sometimes we need to think. Here's one of my favorite verses in the Bible. What does the Lord require of you? It actually is my favorite verse in the Bible, to be honest. To act justly and to love mercy and to walk humbly with your God. Act justly, love mercy, walk humbly with your God. Christians ought to support all forms of justice. I've already said that. Are Christians too political? No, they're probably not political enough. So who do I vote for then? Last thing, just for funsies. I don't know who you should vote for. There's these things called the left and right of politics, which you might have heard of, and you probably put yourself on one side or the other. The problem is the parties aren't consistent. So here's actually the five of the areas of politics that you might care about: economy, welfare, foreign affairs, ethics, and law and order. I'm not going to hold this up here for long because it's not that interesting. But here's my attempt to put each of the political parties on each of those spectrums. They're all over the shop. Right? That's the point. There's no party that aligns with you, is there? You know this already. Like every party, you think, I agree with that bit, I disagree with that bit. That's the challenge of it. It's not as easy to think when it comes to voting. I would add one thing. If you are interested in the science of government, just so you know, you can change where your party sits on those lines. Because as I said at the beginning, the pool of talent in political parties is very shallow. They are desperate for people. There's not many members. If like 2,000 Christians joined any of these parties, they could probably change the entire policy platform of them within 3 years, I reckon. Like, That's how they work. They work by numbers. It's arithmetic, as John Howard said. So, you can change where your party sits. Like, you can look through these and think, where's best? And the problem is that actually they're all best. I'll give you just one example so you know what I'm talking about. So, in terms of foreign affairs, the right is nationalist, which sees the world as a bunch of states all competing against each other, and you should care most about your country and try and see it win. And competition is sometimes a good thing, right? We play sport to be competitive, and the competition makes us better. By competing, we get better. So there's actually a good side to seeing the world as a bunch of competing states. But it's also good to be internationalist, because there are some issues that can't be solved by one country on its own. A good example of that would be child pornography. If only one country tried to do anything about that, guess what? It wouldn't be enough. The world needs to unite on the issue to do anything about it. So there's two issues that, I agree with you. We need to be internationalist on that one, and that's the point. I think it was Tim Keller who basically just said, unless you are directly interested in the science of government, unless you want to run, you should probably not align yourselves too closely with any political party, but just put yourself in a position where you can be equally critical of where they're going and have your say. I think there's some wisdom in that, to be honest. And that is all I have got. The end. Thanks very much for listening.
Thanks for joining us for this presentation from North Pine Baptist Church. For more information and to connect with us, visit npbc.org.au.